Washington waits, Detroit watches.
Sure, they've made some bad decisions. What corporation doesn't? But I just find it just a little irritating that they'd be willing to bail out the banks with such vigor and, you know, leave a manufacturing mecca, you know, out to dry.
Help for the U.S. auto industry is stalled in Congress, and all GM retiree Dave Anderson can do is watch. A car wreck in slow-mo with 3 million American workers in the back seat. Try and look away. That's your takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 20th. Good morning, John. It does look like a bailout plan for the auto industry may have lost its steam on Capitol Hill there.
Nothing to report there. Good morning, Adora.
And this morning, we're going to take a look at pensions and some thoughts on Capitol Hill about changes in those, and perhaps some good news out of battle-ridden Congo with reports of a ceasefire and the story about how many billions the U.S. has borrowed from China. That and more, but first, these headlines.
Another day of losses on world markets. Key European indices have been down today, but appear to be holding steady at this hour. They're down just 1 to 2%. Asian markets had heavy losses earlier. Japan's Nikkei was hardest hit. It closed down nearly 7%. And it all follows the worst day on Wall Street in 5.5 years. The Dow broke the 8,000 barrier to close at 79.97. Every stock on the Dow, all 30, were down. Banks had huge losses. Citigroup alone posted a $9 billion one-day shrinkage, and the futures market seems to be rallying at this point. A flat open is predicted in about an hour and a half from now.
And John, investors were clearly not happy about Congress's deadlock on Detroit's fate. The heads of the big three automakers left empty-handed yesterday after 2 days of making their case for a $25 billion bailout. House Minority Leader John Boehner says nothing's going to change.
Until I see a plan, and until there are hearings about that plan, I think that our opposition is rooted in trying to protect the American taxpayer.
The White House says Congress still could come up with the money. It just has to use some funds reserved for developing more fuel-efficient cars. And new jobless numbers come out this morning. The Senate is considering adding another 13 weeks to unemployment benefits. President Bush has threatened a veto.
Two members of the Obama transition team will meet today with Defense Secretary Robert Gates. They'll be talking about making a smooth transition of power at the Pentagon. And another key position in Barack Obama's cabinet has been announced. Former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle will become the head of Health and Human Services, subject to Senate confirmation.
California Supreme Court has decided to review legal challenges to Proposition 8, the voter initiative that bans same-sex marriage. They should have a decision by March. No new marriages can take place before then.
It's a fire sale. Oil's just above $52 a barrel. And we need your help, America, not about the oil. We're a nation of debtors, and we need some advice.
My debt was paid down by not using my credit cards anymore and paying only cash for everything.
That works. Cash still works. We want your most creative or unusual methods for lowering debt. It's part of our series, Debtor Nation, this week. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
For some people, it's the dreaded B word, budget.
Budget. Can
just
you do a budget?
Just saying no, using cash. How do you do it? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The lottery? No, we haven't had that one yet.
Not yet.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It wasn't a terribly successful trip for the heads of the big three automakers when they made their way to Washington, D.C. They tried and failed to convince lawmakers that they too urgently need help in this financial downturn. After 2 days of testimony, they went back to Detroit empty-handed. Also on the Hill, a clash in Democratic leadership. We turn to Todd Zwillick, reporter for PRI's Capital News Connection, for a wrap. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
So is it fair to say today that the bailout proposal for the auto industry is dead?
Still not dead, but circling the drain. Isn't that what they say? There will be probably a procedural vote today, and there doesn't look like there are 60 votes, and you always need that magical 60 votes. It doesn't look like there are 60 for any approach that's out there. There is one bipartisan group that's trying to find a compromise. I don't think anybody has a whole lot of confidence that they'll get it. So if nothing coalesces around 60 for some form of money for the auto companies, what they'll wind up doing is probably trying to pass a 13-week extension for unemployment benefits for everyone who's lost their job, and then head on home.
I want to get your reaction to some sound that you got from Senator Chris Dodd.
There are other options for dealing with this in the absence of Congress being here. So it isn't as if there are no other means by which you could deal with a situation that came right up to the brink.
So what was he talking about, Todd?
Well, it seems like Chris Dodd kind of started throwing cold water on this whole idea of an auto bailout, you know, a couple of weeks ago, while everyone else, a lot of other Democrats were pushing the idea. Dodd, I don't know if you remember, came out about a week and a half ago out of a hearing and said, yeah, it's a good idea. I just don't think we have the votes for it. And right away, you see the chairman of the Banking Committee throwing cold water on this. What he's saying there, and that's what he said late yesterday, it seems like he's laying the groundwork, reassuring people, reassuring the markets that if Congress goes home today or tomorrow with no immediate money for the auto companies, that yes, Treasury, if they reach the brink, if GM goes under between now and February or January when there's a new Congress and a new administration who may be more willing to do something, Treasury has the ability or Federal Reserve has the ability in an emergency to step in with some money. So there's even a lifeline there, is what he's saying.
Okay, so we'll just keep watching and waiting to see if something comes of that. But let's turn now to this clash, it seems, between Michigan's John Dingell and California's Henry Waxman.
Yeah, clash of the Titans. Have you ever watched football on Fox, either of you, at any time?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know when the two football helmets sort of collide and sparks and smoke fly out everywhere and it's a colossal explosion?
Yes.
This is kind of the house version of that. These two.
That's totally John, awesome.
John Dingell, 27 terms in the House. Third longest serving member of Congress in history. Henry Waxman, 18 terms. Doesn't have as much seniority as Dingell, right? Challenging Dingell for his gavel on the Energy and Commerce Committee. And what's at stake this morning in the vote in the Democratic caucus? Control over huge chunks of health care policy, energy policy, global warming. You know, no big deal. So the stakes are huge. The committee's huge. Henry Waxman won a vote in the Steering and Policy Committee yesterday. That's a 50-member committee. Think of that as kind of a primary for the Democratic caucus. Waxman won that vote 25 to 22, I believe, or 25 to 21. It's extremely rare for a chairman like Dingell to lose a vote like that. It doesn't necessarily mean Waxman's going to win today. It's a secret ballot. You don't know how people are going to vote. But it was rare yesterday for Dingell to lose that vote, so they vote this morning.
And so what does that say to you about what's going on? Is it a fundamental approach issue?
Well, we'll see. It's going to be very interesting. You know, if members really do have a choice here between these two candidates. Dingell, throughout his career, look, he's from Michigan, very pro. His wife is a famous GM lobbyist, pro-auto industry, their staunchest defender in Congress, pro-business, and very moderate, kind of slow-moving on environment and global warming issues. So if people vote for him, they vote to protect seniority. John Dingell's our most honored member. We protect his seniority. We're not going to kick him out. He hasn't done anything wrong. That's one approach. The other approach is Henry Waxman. He's liberal. He's aggressive on the environment. He's aggressive in regulating industry. And he's aggressive against he has been aggressive against the Republican administration. Mm-hmm. If members say we want it, you know, Barack Obama has this first 2 years where he has big ideas. He wants real change, drastic change. If people see Henry Waxman as the means to that, and you're a liberal and you want big change on the environment, big change on health care, big change on energy, you might vote Waxman. So
Waxman,
I think those are the dynamics.
Waxman is a much better Halloween mask, I think, than Dingell.
They're both not bad.
Oh, my. Todd Dwillick, thanks again for that report, and we'll certainly be checking in with you on that vote. Todd Dwillick, Capital News Connection for PRI.
Oh, no. For all you need to know, go, go, Todd Dwillick.
One of the traumas of this financial meltdown has been opening your 401k and looking at the shrinking balance as investments begin to shrink along with everything else in the world that's investment grade. Companies with pensions and pension liabilities are also opening their statements and seeing that their assets have shrunk. In fact, it's estimated that pensions have shrunk by $250 billion. And it means that companies theoretically need to put up more money to cover their pension liabilities to workers who are about to retire or who are retired. Joining us to talk about a change in the rules that may benefit companies but make pensions more vulnerable is Mary Williams Walsh, who's a New York Times reporter, joining us from New York. Mary, thanks for being a part of the show.
Good morning.
Explain to me what rule it is that companies are looking to change and how it affects the vulnerability or strength of pensions in America.
Yeah, it's a rule that dates all the way back to the 1970s, and it's called ERISA. It's a federal law, and it says basically if you operate a pension fund as a company, you have to put money behind the benefits you've promised. You're not supposed to just promise and never fund the pensions. And so it was just amended 2 years ago because there'd been a lot of bankruptcies, and it was clear that there were loopholes in the law before, and so they were trying to tighten up the loopholes. But now everybody's had all these losses, and so they're saying, well, sorry, but we don't have the money right now. We can't make next year's contributions, and can you give us a little bit of relief on this?
And the issue is jobs on both sides of the equation. Companies saying that if they have to put up cash, you know, cash that they don't necessarily have, to back pensions, they can't use it for operations, which means they may have to lay off workers or close down facilities. On the other hand, if they don't put up the money, the pension liabilities are maybe at risk, and that people who think they have a pension don't at all. How do you think, I mean, first of all, how much money is at stake here, and how will changing the rules shuttle the balance sheet?
The idea was basically, well, first let me say there's a guarantor in the United States for pensions. This kind of a benefit is guaranteed by the federal government just the way a bank deposit would be guaranteed by the FDIC. There's an entity like that to cover pensions. And so what you don't want to do is let that thing, you know, just like we don't want the FDIC to get into trouble because it's a very important thing, we don't want the pension guarantor to not get enough money either. So if you're not funding your pension, you're sort of compromising that federal program. And it's a very important federal program to lots and lots of people.
But that federal guarantor, I mean, we've already seen the airlines basically dumping their pensions into that federal guarantor. How exposed is that guarantor to more such bankruptcies if companies are allowed to lower the amount of reserve money they have to put up to cover pension liabilities?
Yeah, that's exactly the problem. It was not set up to, like, absorb huge $10 billion losses all in one time. That's what it happened with United Airlines. It went bankrupt, and then just one company can end up, you know, throwing all of these obligations onto the federal government. And the guarantor, I mean, it's like an insurance company. It's like a pooled thing where it doesn't cover – everybody knows every pension fund isn't going to melt down. But you have to have enough money on hand for the ones that do.
Well, let's talk about, in the last minute that we have here, about pensioners. I mean, they're waking up this morning. It appears, according to your article, that Congress is actually sympathetic to this change in the rules. Should pensioners worry today?
You should. Your pension fund can't really fail unless your company goes bankrupt in the first place. And so if you have a nice, strong company with a good credit rating and, you know, it can still fund your plan, you don't have to worry. If you are an auto worker, you know, and your company is sort of teetering and asking for a bailout anyway, those are the kinds of companies where it goes into the federal guarantor. And it can sometimes happen very, very fast.
And in fact, it's all about showing your cards. A lot of these companies, we don't know the bad news until they lay the cards on the table. Mary Williams Walsh, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mary Williams Walsh has a piece on the changing rules for pensions and companies that hold pensions for workers in today's New York Times.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. This week we're exploring the notion of debt in America, and we're looking for your advice. How did you get out of debt, stay out of debt?
Bobby Gosnell, Pawnee, Oklahoma. My daughter just graduated from college a couple of years ago. No debt because, large part, money my father left me because he belonged to the Communication Workers of America. Unions work.
What's the most creative way that you've managed to lower your debt or get rid of debt altogether? Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. John?
The question of poverty in America is one that has persisted since the 1960s when Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty, a war that some say is stalled on the battlefield. But today, people slipping into poverty at a time of broad economic downturn is certainly a lonely, lonely feeling, the feeling of Janie Larson, who's just lost her home in Columbus, Ohio.
I will have 15 to 20 days to remove my belongings or they'll lock the doors. So I'm looking for a place to move to. I haven't moved in 38 years, so I am terrified.
The terror of being part of the working poor in America. It's perhaps at the top of the list of America's briefing book for the new president, Barack Obama, who has pledged to deal with poverty in a more aggressive way since at any time since the war on poverty was declared by Lyndon Johnson back in the 1960s. If we were to add a page to America's briefing book this morning on poverty, we could do no better than to talk to David Shipler, who's the author of The Working Poor, Invisible in America, a former New York Times reporter. David Shipler, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Explain, first of all, who the working poor are and how is it a different population from what Lyndon Johnson observed back in the mid-60s?
I don't know that it is different. Working poor are people who do work, but at very low wages that put them below the poverty line, or if they're above it, they're not far enough above it to make any difference in their living standards. You know, most poor families in the United States are headed by single adults, and most of them are women. So essentially they have one wage earner, and if they're earning anything less, if they have three children, for example, and they're earning anything less than $10 plus an hour, they're below the poverty line.
And according to the U.S. Census, it's 37.3 million people in America living in poverty, and 700,000 children went hungry in America at some point in 2007. When the war on poverty was declared in the 1960s, a broad set of programs reduced the poverty rate from 23% down to 13% in only 5 years. Can Barack Obama expect to accomplish something like that with any program that's envisioned so far?
I think there are possibilities, and in a way, the economic crisis presents an opportunity. If the Congress is willing and if Obama is willing to think big, it seems to me that major government spending, and of course it would have to be deficit spending at this point, you don't raise taxes in the middle of a severe recession, that would, for example, pour money into improving and creating infrastructure and at the same time upgrading skills of people who then could work in many of these projects. I mean, one of the huge problems the United States has is not just an income disparity, but a disparity in skills where many people just don't have the ability to work in jobs that provide decent wages or an improvement in their wages. I mean, that's the main thing, that you get into an entry-level job and you're stuck there and you can't advance. So there needs to be extensive vocational training, job training, and government money into private organizations that do this kind of work would be very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
We've also had a real turndown in the last 8 years of housing subsidies. And housing turns out to be a key link in a chain reaction of problems for families in poverty. You know, poverty isn't just a problem. It's a whole constellation of problems that magnify one another. So poor housing has tremendous impacts in many respects. You mentioned hunger. One of the problems is that families that don't have any housing subsidies from government that are on the private market, if they're working at low wages, can end up paying 50 to 70% of their income for rent. And rent isn't something you can avoid. You've got to write that check every month. You've got to make the car payment if you have to have a car to get to work. The part of the budget that can be squeezed is for food. And studies have shown that there's a high correlation between families without housing subsidies and underweight children. And then, of course, you can go on and look at the results of that. I mean, malnutrition in the first 2 to 3 years of a child's life, when brain development is critical, can create lifelong cognitive impairment, which in turn
So
means
you're really describing a cascading domino of problems that are interrelated. But one thing that I'd like you to talk a little bit about is how important it is for the government first to figure out how the bureaucracy works. You talk about turf wars, and in order to implement any of the programs to address the issues you just listed, you talk about how important it is for the government to get its own house in order first.
Well, I think, I don't know if it's first, but along the way, certainly one of the problems we see is the balkanization of funding, so that you get the different kinds of programs overlapping or leaving gaps between them, different agencies responsible for different kinds of programs. And the trouble with that is that what we really need are gateways through which poverty or people in poverty can walk to get multiple services.
And those were the kinds of things that Johnson managed to accomplish in the 60s. Very quickly, are you optimistic about Barack Obama?
Yes, I am. I think he understands this from his days of community organizing. I think he's beginning to put together a good team. And because we have this economic crisis, I think he has a good rationale and excuse to think big and take major action.
Well, we'll see how big and major on day one when the Obama administration takes office. David Shipler, thank you. David Shipler is the author of The Working Poor, Invisible in America, as part of America's briefing book for the new president, Barack Obama. Headlines now from Mark Garrison.
Thank you. 28 minutes after the hour, markets in Europe are down. Major indices are down about 1.5%. That follows heavy losses in Asia earlier today. Wall Street looks headed to a relatively flat opening. We'll see how investors react to unemployment figures out in about 2 minutes. The Senate takes up a bill today that would extend those extend unemployment benefits by an extra 7 weeks and even longer in especially hard-hit states. Earlier applications for them reached the highest rate in 14 years. The European Union is launching a digital library today. It'll provide online access to millions of items from European creators, over 2,000 years worth of it. Plenty of variety, everything from the recipe for the croque monsieur to paintings, books. Apparently very popular so far. It even froze under the weight of about 10 million hits an hour. I just tried to check it out a minute ago. I got server temporarily unavailable, so refresh often. On to lit news for newer work. Annette Gordon-Reed took home the National Book Award for nonfiction yesterday. She won for a biography of three generations of a slave family owned by Thomas Jefferson. Peter Mathiasen won for fiction. That is for Shadow Country.
Great. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Come on, America. You know the story. Your brother-in-law comes to you and says, hey, John, I need your help. It's my debt.
Hi, my name is Laura Ann. I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York. I just thought the listeners might like to know there's a program called Debtors Anonymous. It's a 12-step program based on Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you Google it, it comes right up. It's been an invaluable resource for me and many, many of my friends. Thanks for doing the series on debting.
That's right. We are doing a series all week on debt in America, and we want your tips and tricks on getting rid of debt. Help us lower our debt load at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We can do this, America.
John, there may be some progress in the conflict in the Congo. After weeks of intense fighting between the Congo government and rebel forces, there may be progress after weekend talks with a UN envoy. The conflict is a complex web of ethnic troubles involving the Congo's neighbors, fights over valuable resources, and deals with China. Meanwhile, an estimated 1 million civilians have been displaced. 3 million have died, mostly through disease and starvation in this lengthy civil war. We turn now to Thomas Fessy, a BBC correspondent who is joining us from Goma. Good morning, Thomas. Who was the UN envoy and what prompted the rebels led by Laurent Nkunda to pull back?
Well, the UN special envoy came over last Sunday and is the former Nigerian president Olusegun Obasanjo. He was mandated by the General Secretary of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, to come over to Congo and try to secure the ceasefire and boost the talks between the rebels and the Congolese government here. So he met with the rebels' leader, Laurent Nkunda. And after that, Laurent Nkunda and his troops said that they would actually withdraw from the last positions they had taken a few days ago, which they actually did yesterday.
The rebel leader says that he's trying to protect ethnic Tutsis and that he's protesting a deal that the government made with China relative to gold and coltan. What did he get in return for pulling back?
Well, at the moment, there's nothing really in return. As a matter of fact, the government is not taking the position to say that Laurent Nkunda is the one to decide what's going to happen. And the Congolese government still officially say that there will be no direct talks with the rebels, but they want to stay within the peace process that would sign late January. Laurent Nkunda has actually changed his message over the past few weeks because, as you mentioned, his early rebellion was supposed to be in favor of the protection of ethnic Tutsis here in North Kivu, a minority which Laurent Nkunda wanted to protect from against the Hutus rebels coming from Rwanda after the genocide in Rwanda. Now, Laurent Nkunda has been saying for the past few weeks that he wants to take his fight to Kinshasa and he wants to free the whole country from the current government. So he basically changed his movement into a total liberation movement for Congo.
There are currently 17,000 UN peacekeepers on the ground there, and I understand that the Security Council was due to vote on adding an additional 3,000. What role have they been playing, and do you think 3,000 more troops might help calm things in the region?
Well, the UN peacekeeping mission, known as MONUC, has been deployed for years now, and the mandate is quite confusing because, on the one hand, MONUC is here to protect civilians, but on the other hand, it is not very clear whether when a MONUC can actually intervene in the fighting. Its mandate says that they can intervene when civilians and urban areas are actually put at risk. But the recent fighting showed that the interpretation of that mandate wasn't that clear. Now, the Security Council will take a decision on the resolution that was already agreed by all permanent members in the UN. It should be the decision should be taken on the 26th, whether or not to send about 3,000 more troops troops, including several hundred police officers. It seems that several countries already involved in the UN peacekeeping mission, such as India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, have been contacted by the UN. But it is likely that these troops are going to be sent to North Kivu to reinforce MONUC here. But it is also clear that without political talks, there will not be such a change here in North Kivu, as it is quite clear that the solution is not going to be a military solution.
And meanwhile, aid is very difficult to get to those who need it. Thomas Fessy, thank you. Thomas Fessy is a BBC correspondent. He was coming to us from Goma. And now we turn to Mark Garrison, who's got some headlines for us.
Thank you. Coming up on 21 minutes before the hour, oil prices hit their lowest point in almost 2 years yesterday, slumming at as low as $52 a barrel. They've dropped more than 60% since their peak in July. Low oil prices are good for drivers, but no breaks so far for the companies making the cars. A bailout for the auto industry is basically on hold. Senate Democrats who support it don't think they have the votes. The leadership postponed a vote scheduled for today. The White House wants to keep the $700 billion in bailout money reserved for financial firms. Anti-government protesters were attacked by grenade today in Bangkok, killing one and wounding tens more. They've been protesting since August, calling for the Thai prime minister to resign. And quick note, the fine public radio program On the Media lives and works just above us. It's a great program. They have a lot of sharp reporting on the state of journalism, you know, raising issues of shrinking newsroom staff, the struggling newspaper industry, conflicts
you're
of interest.
You're applying for a job there?
No. I'm just saying, you know, so,
yeah, sure.
You know, all
please,
that. But
please continue.
I just want to report on a bright spot is that Ecuadorian dwarfs are not being undercover. They've kind of become
Ecuadorian dwarves.
Dwarves, yes. They've become media stars lately, covered in print. I mean, ABC is actually doing two stories on them just tonight alone. And so I just wanted for our listeners that might be a little overwhelmed by the, you know, emphasis on dwarves of Ecuador, I'll just give you kind of the cliff notes on why they're in that. There's about 100 people in Ecuador that have Laron syndrome that stunts their growth. They don't get above 4 feet tall. Most of the patients with this rare disease are there. And scientists are interested because actually the entire population of these Laron dwarves, no one has ever died of cancer, even though live in an area with high rates of that like that. So now you now know everything you need to know.
Right. It is. And what does this have to do with On the Media? Ecuadorian dwarves?
Well, you know, just that some things are being covered.
Nothing. Yes. It has nothing whatsoever to do with
that.
Not
media. At all.
Okay. Thank you,
it's
Mark.
It's a media story.
Thank you, Mark. He was dreaming of dwarves last night when he woke up this morning. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And if you're worried about the biting cold winter wind outside as you prepare to go to work, think about the bracing winds on Wall Street and markets around the world. Joining us now is Hank Potts, analyst at Barclays Wealth. He joins us from London. We've got more capitulation taking place in Asian markets, Hank, after a very, very difficult day on Wall Street, the Dow closing below 8,000, the S&P 500 closing below 800. What does it look like this morning?
It's looking pretty miserable here in London, as you'd probably expect. The follow-through coming into the European bourses as well. The FTSE currently down 90 points. That's 2.2%. I think you're quite right to point out we have got global issues out there. We've got contracting economic growth. Of course, the Fed painted a pretty bleak picture of the US economy, talking about slowing economic growth during the course of this year, contraction next year. We've got declining corporate profitability. We've got rising unemployment, which, of course, is filtering through to much weaker household demand. We continue to see the deleveraging process coming through. And that's a pretty powerful mix of short-term negativity. So no real surprise, I think, that equity markets are under pressure.
Although it seems to me, Hank, that based on what the Fed was saying yesterday and Paulson's comments earlier in the week as well, that the extent and the severity of the recession is overtaking the positive news in the liquidity markets, in the credit markets, that the ability to lend bank to bank and business to business in the commercial paper market isn't having much impact because operations are slowing so severely that people actually don't need to borrow. They don't need to fund operations because they don't expect to have much of them.
Well, I guess you can argue that both ways. They haven't been able to fund their operations, hence we've seen the slowdown coming through. I think you're right to point out we are seeing some more positive signs coming through from the credit markets. Analysts continue to look at those LIBOR rates, those interbank lending rates, which have been coming down. That's seen as a key measure of how much trust there is amongst the banks, although the spreads, you have to say, while have tightened, are still at historically quite high levels coming through. And we have to also, I think, point out that actually the US economy is perhaps in better shape, or the predictions for the US economy are in better shape than we're seeing from economies elsewhere, particularly the Eurozone and here in the UK. At least the authorities in the United States have been aggressive in terms of cutting interest rates. I think they're certainly seen as being ahead of the curve compared to the Bank of England and the European Central Bank, who've waited and waited and waited for inflation to come under control. Now that's dropping like a stone, and they're having to be extra aggressive in terms of cutting interest rates.
Right.
And of course, your use of fiscal policy has certainly been seen as a benefit, and continued use of that should protect the US economy from a recession turning into a depression.
Well, there's a silver lining there, Hank. If the canaries in the coal mine aren't already all dead at this point, what are you watching today? Is it the level of the Dow or the S&P? Is it Citigroup's stock price as a bellwether, which is now, you know, $6 and change right now?
Yesterday, as you quite rightly say, there is some confidence crisis going on there. Their shares down 23%, I think, yesterday.
Quickly, what are you watching today? Very quickly.
Well, we'll watch out for the data coming through from Barnes & Noble, Freddie Mac, Dow. A lot of companies reporting. She gives a better clue from the U.S.
All right. Hank Potts, analyst at Barclays Wealth, on the line from London, watching a very miserable day on world markets from Asia to Europe and an expected lower opening on Wall Street. Thanks, Hank.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 20th. Mark Garrison is here with the latest headlines. Mark?
Thank you. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, big economic news just out a few minutes ago. Jobless numbers at a 16-year high, worse than economists expected. Some 542,000 applications for unemployment benefits in the U.S. Word now that Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano is President-elect Barack Obama's top choice to be Secretary of Homeland Security. Also, our partners at the New York Times say Chicago businesswoman Penny Pritzker is his leading choice for Commerce Secretary. She headed up fundraising for Obama's campaign. The U.S. military says a leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq was killed last week during a raid by American forces in Baghdad. The man was blamed for the kidnapping and murder of an Army reservist in 2004 and an attack in June that killed more than 25 people. Pakistan is officially complaining about the most recent suspected American missile strikes. They brought their complaint to the U.S. ambassador directly. They allegedly hit deeper inside Pakistan or territory than earlier strikes near the border with Afghanistan. Militants are threatening revenge attacks. General Motors financing arm GMAC is asking the Fed to become a bank holding company. That, of course, would make it eligible for a slice of the $700 billion bailout package.
Some think that may be the back channel way of getting the bailout that Congress will not vote explicitly.
Obviously, the big three automaking companies were turned down, so that could be another way to get at that. That's your news.
Thank you, Mark. So all this week we've been focusing on debtor nation. America is the debtor nation. We've been doing a series all week long. We've been hearing stories about personal debt, personal finance, getting in and out of debt, strategies for dealing with some of the most frustrating financial situations that we all get into. But today we thought we'd look at debt in America itself It's a story not simply of finance. It's a story of a nation changing its identity in the last two generations. And joining us to talk about it is Kevin Phillips, the author of Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. Kevin Phillips, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning.
You know, one of the things that I find so compelling about the things that you write about, particularly as regards the credit crisis and the financial meltdown, is how underlying this story of day-to-day market fluctuations is really a deeper story of how America's identity in the world has fundamentally changed over the last two generations. Can you remind us what that identity change is?
Well, we've become a culture of debt. The United States as a nation is the world's leading debtor nation now. If you go back to the period right after World War I, we began to be the world's leading creditor nation, but we've left that far behind. If you look at the period during which Alan Greenspan was heading the Federal Reserve from 1987 to 2006, what they call total credit market debt in the United States, that's the combined total of private and public debt, went from roughly $11 trillion up to the neighborhood of $45 trillion. I mean, that's quadrupling.
And that's what everybody owes. That's everybody, government, personal, everybody. That's what's owed.
Well, it's what's owed in the form of something that's tradable. It doesn't include something that would be a contract or sort of over-the-counter structured financial product.
Right, right. Now, it was just announced by the Treasury yesterday that China has passed Japan as the sort of top lender to the United States. We're told repeatedly that for some reason, the spending of American consumers is the engine that drives the global economy. Yet, if that money is coming from China, it seems as though the engine's in one place and the fuel tank is in another place. How do you get a car out of that?
Well, I think the problem is that the Chinese have the leverage at this point because they have been very shrewd as they've sold a lot of things to the United States. They've collected the money as opposed to just racing out and spending it on things, and they've got huge reserves, and basically they have the wherewithal to squeeze us quite a bit so that it'd be very hard for us to cut off their access to this market. But the difficulty is that if you've got a country that has an awful lot of money sitting around, which China is described that way now, and you have a country like this that just keeps spending more than it takes in and encourages a culture of debt, at a certain point you put your head in the noose.
And Kevin, does anyone know exactly how much money the U.S. owes China?
Well, it's not a question of how much money the United States owes China. It's how much we have borrowed, at least that's the description, when we sell them debt securities. And the debt securities they have of one variety or another, you've got about $1 trillion.
So let's talk a little bit about that noose that you kind of ominously, referred to a moment ago. There are people who wander around the streets of New York with sandwich boards shrieking about the deficit. There's the debt clock that supposedly obligates me to some crazy amount of money that myself and my children are going to have to pay off. You describe this sort of political noose of eroding power in the world if you borrow too much and are too much beholden to nations like China. What is the real life consequence to having your, head in this noose that you're talking about?
Well, if you go back and you look historically at what happened to previous leading world economic powers, generally speaking, having too much debt was always a major part of their downfall. It was often linked to being too extended in terms of overseas military and political commitment. But to get as far out on a ledge as we are probably means you can never really get back. History doesn't let you sort of, walk back and take the scene over again. And I realize that sounds like a horrible thing to say, but basically what it means is we're going to have to pay the piper. And unfortunately, paying the piper seems to take the form of circumstances like we've seen in the last 10 weeks, where basically your financial system comes unglued because people are just figuring out that, A, they don't know exactly what's in parts of it, and B, the banks don't know either, and C, the government can't get its act together. And the combination of all these things now is writ large across the horizon, and in stock market problems, in retirement accounts, in pension funds, in crumbling university endowments. These are chickens coming home to roost.
Although we still have the biggest chicken coop in the world in terms of the economy, and our economy is the largest in the world by a fairly substantial margin. I guess the question is there a bellwether in terms of these wealth funds like China and Japan and in Saudi Arabia? Is there a moment where they go, you know what, I'm not going to loan you any more money? Is there some sort of cross the Rubicon kind of landmark event that we should watch for between now and, you know, the next president taking office, two terms away from now?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think there's a single landmark event that's likely to occur. The way these things usually work is that nobody makes any announcement that they're not going to buy American Treasury debt anymore, or that they're going to start putting together gold reserves and taking a number of other measures. They just do it quietly, and then some crisis comes up where you think that you're still able to do what you did a year or two ago, and lo and behold, you're not.
Wow.
Nobody blows a trumpet and says, hey, we're tired of you.
Well, let's change the subject. Kevin, do you pay the minimums on your credit card bills?
Just to get personal.
Do you pay how do you handle your own debt?
I pay the bill.
You pay the bill.
And I'm an old man. My parents were Depression people, and I never learned to do it the other way.
And you own your own house?
Correct.
All right. Well, Kevin Phillips, sitting pretty there in Connecticut. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kevin Phillips is the author of Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. I sensed a little na-na-na-na-na there from Kevin. I hope I'm in as good a shape as he is.
I think he was explicit in saying that he's learned his lesson.
Yes.
Of course, he was talking about debt and the nation's staggering debt.
My name is Sean from Bradley Beach, and I want to tell you that I think that the greatest economist to ever live, who knew all about this stuff, was my mom. She said, always save for a rainy day. Always have money in the bank safely tucked away. Because when you need money on a rainy day, you can use it. Our government should be doing the same thing. It should have saved. It should have saved when it had surpluses. And that way, when things get slow, they can put out a big economic stimulus package.
I love
save
that guy.
Save for a rainy day.
She should be Secretary of the Treasury. Secretary of the Treasury.
Well, she had some good advice and certainly hasn't hurt him much. What's the best way, you think? You want to add to that list of things to do to stay out of debt or get out of debt?
Good morning. Troy calling from North Dakota. Debt reduction or cost-cutting strategy, try paring down the number of vehicles you insure. I don't know about East Coasters, but Midwesterners love their multiple vehicles. Figure out the minimum you need to function. Go with that. My wife and son and I make it work with one car because I can walk or ride my bike to work, and that has uncomplicated my financial life considerably.
Our friend Troy out on the prairie of North Dakota. Susan from Brooklyn writes, my husband and I are making our last payment tomorrow on our last debt. We've paid off $8,000 in the past 30 months. The secret, the dreaded budget, lots of overtime, and learning to tell yourself no. No, John. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adore Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Okay, guys, time to get moving.
We're in the Pepsi generation.
During a more hopeful time, advertisers wrote the slogans for a new age.
Who is the Pepsi generation? Just about everyone with the young view of things.
active, livelier people with a liking for Pepsi-Cola.
Well, they're looking for new slogans today as the Pepsi generation grows up and counts its pennies. Advertisers selling recession by the pound. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 20th. Good morning, John. And I don't think I've ever heard of a young view of things. Isn't that rather obvious?
Me.
I thought advertisers
were
supposed to be subtle.
I'm young. I'm free. I'm part of the Pepsi generation. Good morning, Adora. You want to ask me about this stuff? Trends, new trends.
Well, we have some news today, actually. More names for President-elect Obama's cabinet. Advertising in an age of economic troubles, as you just basically inferred there in your open. And the looting of ancient Egyptian, Turkish, Italian, and Greek art. It is a sensational story. That and more, but first we have headlines.
All very serious. Another day of losses on world markets. Key European indices have been down today 2-3%. Asian markets had heavy losses. The Nikkei was the hardest hit. And it was the worst day on Wall Street yesterday in 5.5 years. All 30 of the stocks that make up the Dow Jones Industrial Average were down. The index broke the 8,000 barrier to close at 79.97. Banks had huge losses yesterday. Citigroup alone tumbled more than 23%. The Dow futures are already down more than 100 points before the opening.
And sadly, the bad economic news just keeps on coming. Jobless numbers came out this morning. The number of people making first-time unemployment claims rose to 542,000 last week. That's the highest level in 16 years. The Senate might have some relief for people on unemployment. It's debating adding 13 more weeks to the current 26 week of benefits. The plan's already passed the House, but President Bush has threatened a veto.
Detroit's fate in a deadlock. The heads of the three major automakers left empty-handed yesterday. House Minority Leader John Boehner says he's still against carving out a $25 billion bailout.
Until I see a plan, and until there are hearings about that plan, I think that our opposition is rooted in trying to protect the American taxpayer.
The White House says Congress could still come up with the money. It just has to use funds reserved for other programs like developing more fuel-efficient cars.
Two members of the Obama transition team are scheduled to meet today with Defense Secretary Robert Gates. And there's more news, rumors really. The president-elect's cabinet picks. Former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle will become head of Health and Human Services. Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano looks like the top candidate for Homeland Security.
And Penny Pritzker, according to the New York Times, may be Commerce Secretary. Oil's just above $52 a barrel, and we need your help, America. We need your help. We're in debt, and we don't know how to get up.
My wife is a genius CFO of this family, and we never carry a balance on any of our credit cards, so the interest can go away.
Oh, nice. That's one piece of advice. It's Detonation Week here on The Takeaway. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. America's trying to get out of debt. Give us your advice for doing it, even on your small scale.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today we have more names to add to the group of possible leaders in President-elect Barack Obama's administration. Today, there's Tom Daschle to add to Eric Holder and Senator Hillary Clinton. Names are flying on Capitol Hill, and we go now to Peter Baker, who is a reporter for The New York Times, with the latest. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. How are you? How are you today?
Very well. And yourself, I understand that you're taking a look at whether or not the future Obama administration is come to some kind of deal with former President Clinton that would possibly make way for Senator Hillary Clinton to become Secretary of State.
Sure. Well, what the Clinton people are putting out these days is that Bill Clinton has agreed to every condition that the Obama transition team has requested of him in terms of avoiding future potential conflicts of interest should his wife be named Secretary of State. Now, remember, of course, former President Clinton in the 8 years since he left the White House has had a very energetic career as both business and philanthropic globetrotter. He has foundation fights AIDS and malaria and other things around the world. At the same time, he travels the world and earns very lucrative fees for speaking from foreign businesses and entities. So what the Obama team has talked about is avoiding things like that in the future that would cause potential conflicts. And Bill Clinton has said, sure, whatever it takes.
Is it clear that she's been offered the job, that Barack Obama intends to offer the job? It seems there's been just endless leaks, I suppose, coming from both sides. But what is actually known about what the two have discussed and what the possibility is?
Well, I mean, so far as we know, the job has not been formally offered or formally accepted. But at the same time, I think it's fair to say, and a lot of people in Washington, Democratic circles would tell you that it's hard to imagine that Barack Obama, the president-elect, would have opened the door to this had he already not in his own mind decided this is something he wanted to do. Because otherwise it's going to be a huge blow-up if it doesn't happen. This is, of course, his big primary rival. There was it's been such a soap opera relationship this year. He didn't have to offer her anything in the cabinet. Nobody expected him to consider her for the cabinet. So by simply opening the door to this, to not have at least conceptually in his mind decided this is something he could live with and would want to happen, that's hard to imagine. So everybody thinks that this is something that is on the verge of potentially happening, though nobody is betting on it for sure.
Although, Peter, I got to say, and you're a reporter here, and I don't want to put you on the spot particularly, but it just seems to me with Bill Clinton in the equation and the Secretary of State position involved with, U.S. relations all over the world and the energetic career that you describe of the former president, Bill Clinton, that to really to go forward with this appointment is inviting a kind of target, drawing a target around your administration, and basically Bill Clinton is going to be investigated and scrutinized for everything he does by opponents of Barack Obama throughout the first term.
It's a good question. I mean, clearly, President-elect Obama understands that when you invite the Clintons in to your tent, you accept a certain amount of drama and controversy that comes with that. At the same time, I think that he has decided that you also get some assets. Hillary Clinton is a prominent, celebrity star figure in the Democratic Party and around the world. She's somebody who has entree to a lot of places around foreign capitals, and that Bill Clinton by himself has a pretty darn good reputation around the world, too. We think of his controversies here at home, and there have been many, many investigations over the past number of years. But at the same time, he is well-regarded in foreign capitals and may, help in one of the most important tasks of the Obama administration, which is to repair relations with the rest of the world.
Let's move on to some of the other names that popped up yesterday. Former Senator Tom Daschle.
Sure. Yeah, the next Secretary of Health and Human Services. Tom Daschle was actually a very early and important supporter of Barack Obama's. When Barack Obama came to Washington as a new freshman senator just 4 years ago, Tom Daschle was on the out, having lost his reelection. And he really sort of took Mr. Obama under his wing. He gave Obama a lot of his key staff people, and he encouraged him to make this run for the presidency when a lot of people were saying, wait, it's too early. You need to wait your turn. So this is an important person to Obama, and it's an important position for a president who is promising to make healthcare expansion a key part of his administration. Tom Daschle presumably will be a point person in that fight.
Okay, Peter Baker, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Peter Baker is a reporter for the New York Times. He was coming to us from Washington talking about appointments and possible appointments by President-elect Barack Obama.
That is, of course, one of the dramas going on in Washington. The other is the fate of the big three automakers who all this week were trying to get Congress to approve some sort of package that would financially help these companies, which are losing sales, losing money, and burning cash at a terrifying rate. And I guess, Will Markham, there in Pontiac, Michigan, about all you can do at this point is just watch the slow motion wreck from your perch in Michigan, right?
Yeah, it's very nerve-wracking, that's for sure.
Well, it's nerve-wracking because you are, of course, a retiree. You're in the Skilled Trades Shop Committee of the UAW Local 594 Pontiac East Assembly. Is that right?
Yes, I'm still active.
You're still active, right.
I'm a negotiator for the Skilled Trades Unit.
And you're on the line, actually, right?
No, I do all the. I'm over all the maintenance. You know, keep the line running. You know, do all the repairs.
I mean, do you have a feeling as you watch what's going on in Washington that you have almost no control over your fate?
Oh, it's definitely, and it's so many misconceptions out there, and you can definitely tell that Washington is. Just like in the political, you know, when we went just through this political election, you could tell that they were disconnected with the working class of this country. I think that's why Obama did so well, is because his message actually spoke to so many different sectors of our country right now. And there's just such a disconnect in what actually is going on for your everyday working class out here trying to survive.
You know, we've had economists on the program all week long who have said that they believe one even two automakers are going to go away when we get to the end of this financial meltdown. What do you think is going to happen?
I hope that doesn't happen. I believe that the perfect example is just the bailout on the banks. We have two theories in this country on how we spur the economy. Do we drive it from the bottom up? You know, and that would be the loan that we're asking for, and it's a loan, not a bailout. Or giving the bailout to the banks, and they pull the working class from the top up. We've done that for years, and you and I wouldn't be speaking today if that worked. So to continually think that we're going to throw money at the big corporations that does, you know, or to the banks and things of that nature, and that's going to help the working class, it hasn't worked. We need to keep the middle class working, paying taxes, keeping us employed. We'll buy the products, they'll get their tax money, and everybody will get healthy going forward.
And
you
we're talking
from the bottom up.
We're talking potentially about 3 million workers at the so-called bottom who might be affected if these big three do go out of business. Let's talk for a moment about those congressional hearings. I mean, I used to work, you know, do factory work in Michigan, you know,
yes,
to pay for college. And I'm used to the kind of grumpiness on the line as they talk about management at companies like GM. And there's certainly a tradition of tension between the UAW and management at GM, Ford, and Chrysler. But I can't imagine there was much pleasure watching those three executives really with their hat in hand on Capitol Hill this week.
Well, it's almost even watching the senators and the congressmen and everything speak. I mean, it was almost, you know, the kettle calling the pot black. I mean, they've not done a great job of running this country. You know what I'm saying? The decisions they've made has backfired. You make decisions. I do it myself every day in negotiations. I make decisions on the facts that I have at the moment. And when you have an economy, you have a stock market, you have everything that is changing by the seconds, it's very hard to stay on the front pace of it. I don't think it's time to be pointing fingers on who did what wrong. You know, we had a vote. Our voice was heard. God bless America and the democratic process. It's time to heal this country, and it's time to move forward. And the only way we can do that is by empowering the working class of this country, keep people working, give people a fair wage, and let us drive the economy. That's what we were based on. That's what we're about in this country. And the true patriarchs of this country are the working class, and you've worked that line.
Will, yeah, I've worked the line. Quickly,
yes,
before you go, what is on the line here? Your wages are on the line, right?
Everything's on the
Everything.
Line.
Everything. Your wages, pension, your whole job, the whole thing, right?
Everything. I've relocated three times. I'm what you call a GM gypsy. I started off in Indiana, went to Wisconsin. Now I'm in Michigan chasing my job. It's all on the line.
GM gypsy and GM worker Will Markham, good luck to you and thanks for joining us. Will Markham, Skilled Trade Shop Committee of the United Auto Workers Union, Local 594 Pontiac East Assembly from Pontiac, Michigan. Good luck.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 20th, and John, we're talking about debt, big debt, little debt, more importantly, how you get rid of debt.
Ray from Northbridge. With so much pressure from advertisement and everybody else, everybody wants to have the nicest things and stuff. Don't live above your means. Simple and plain. Don't put things on credit if you can't afford it. That's it.
Just say no.
Just say no.
Just say no.
What do you do to stay out of debt or to lower your debt? Are you just saying no? Are you pinching pennies? What are you doing? We want to hear about it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Well, there are leading indicators and lagging indicators in the economy, and the advertising business is both an industry and a glimpse of the zeitgeist of America. Advertisers write the slogans of American culture, maybe even more in this country than in other places around the world. And when the economy starts to change, the advertisements start to change in both the frequency, people actually advertising on the air, paying for advertisements, and also the style of those ads change. And to talk about that and what it means for sort of American culture and people tracking the economy, Cindy Gallup is an advertising consultant and former chairman of BBH. She's here in the studio with us. Cindy, thanks so much for coming in.
A pleasure.
You know, this is a fascinating subject because advertising changes in two ways. I mean, you've got the auto industry tanking, and they're not advertising as much on television all of a sudden. You also have the style of ads, the focus of ads for, say, retailers changing to focus on discounts and deals. What is your view of the changes that are afoot now that it's pretty clear we're headed into a recession?
Well, I think the first thing you see in a recession, particularly one that is looking as bad as this one, is an immediate, if you like, knee-jerk reaction by many advertisers who, first of all, as you say, often slash their budgets and, secondly, go to a style of advertising that tends to focus very much on discounts and financing rates, et cetera, et cetera. And to be frank, that is not really the way to perpetuate consumer loyalty and to market your brand through a recession.
Well, let's see if this is an example of that. Here's an ad, I believe, from the UK back in 1992 for McDonald's, which was in recession. And here is how McDonald's responded to that in the UK.
This is a Big Mac, Coke and fries. A good square meal. But look at it this way, and it's a good square deal. Just one of the many McDonald's value meal combos, which mean good food and plenty of it, good quality and good value.
So does that ad work in the short term, or, you know, is it tried and true? It certainly seems like a departure from the sort of lifestyle ads you often see at McDonald's.
Sure. I think in the case of McDonald's, you have a brand that has advertised very consistently over a very long period of time and has embedded itself into consumers' lifestyles in a way that means that when they deliver a value message within a recession like this, there will be openness to it, particularly because what people are looking for from McDonald's is something that represents a relatively small expenditure within the context of their lives. Something like the Saved by Zero commercial by Toyota that is irritating a lot of the blogosphere at the moment is more of a demonstration of a very immediate response that isn't necessarily the most productive way to go.
What do you make of the employee pricing strategies that the car companies are using, advertising that they say, we're going to give you the same deal that we give our employees? Does that have any sort of resonance?
Well, to be frank, I think that reflects a bigger point about all advertisers who go to this sort of knee-jerk, low-rate reaction, which is actually the thing that you don't have to tell consumers at the moment is that you need to save money. That's a given. And the more advertisers do that, the more they perpetuate fear and panic that is already permeating the consumer consciousness. I believe there are more productive ways to advertise in a recession.
And Cindy, I just want to add that you've worked through two United Kingdom recessions, a U.S. recession, and a dot-com bubble. And so what are those more productive ways that you think advertisers can deal with the current economic market? And does it really depend on how well-known your brand is?
No, not at all. I think the first thing you absolutely have to demonstrate is a genuine understanding and empathy with the consumer in a situation like this. The brands that take the trouble to really understand how people are re-examining their values and what is important to them at this point, and to then reflect that in the way that their brands can deliver accordingly, are the ones who will make it through.
Well, is that, let's try to get an example of that then. I mean, would an example of that be, say, join the Pepsi generation, where you're creating something that didn't exist before and that sounds really, really hopeful? I mean, are people going to receive a message like that now, or is it something different?
Well, it's interesting you bring up Pepsi, because certainly Pepsi and Coke both managed themselves very well through the last recession, although both of them are looking at quite difficult sales figures now. And I think the reason for that is more that, again, those are brands that have delivered value in the broader sense over a long period of time, and also represent a relatively small level of purchase. So they've managed very well. An example I would highlight is a brand that I was overseeing here in the last recession, which is Johnnie Walker. Diageo, the company responsible for many of the world's best-known alcohol brands, have again marketed very consistently over time. And our message with Johnnie Walker of keep walking represented a spirit and values, if you like, that actually meant the brand held up very well through the last recession.
Speaking of new brands, what do you make of the Barack Obama brand at this point, and from an advertising perspective, how's this brand going to do during the recession?
Well, that's interesting, because the Barack Obama brand at the moment could not be higher in value in the holistic sense. And I think the thing there is really now all about delivering against expectations. And that's the critical thing through a recession, where people believe that Obama represents everything possible about hope and salvation.
So for once, it's out of the advertiser's hands. It's all about the product. Cindy, thank you so much. Cindy Gallup is an advertising consultant and former chairman of BBH, talking about the impact of the recession on the style and frequency of advertisements. And now we have some headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you. We're coming up on 28 minutes after the hour. And
now 29 minutes. Soon it'll be 30 minutes past the hour.
What are you guys doing? Which clock are you looking at?
Give Mark Garrison a break. He's just sitting in for Femia, okay? We have to be nice to him.
You guys are so nice. In any case, House Democrats vote today on the leadership of the committee that has oversight over issues including energy and health care. California's Henry Waxman is challenging John Dingell of Michigan for the chairmanship. The winner will have an impact on President-elect Obama's agenda. Dingell is seen as a supporter of automakers and industry. Waxman is favored by environmentalists. Now, John was curious this morning about the House Office Lottery. This is where freshman members of Congress find out what office they'll occupy. They're picked by random drawing. This happens tomorrow. Now, in things related to Congress, we often turn to our friend Todd Zwillick, reporter for PRI's Capital News Connection, frequent guest. And Todd said the worst collectively are on the fifth floor of
the worst offices.
These are on the fifth floor of the Cannon office building. That's because the Cannon is the worst building, farthest distance, most distance to the House floor. And also most elevators only go to the fourth floor. So that means you got to take the stairs. And then you have a long walk to actually go and vote. So that's what we know from that. So thank you, Todd Zwillick,
freshman,
as always.
Freshman congressman.
Go, go, Todd Zwillick!
Freshman congressmen who find themselves on the fifth floor of the Cannon building are out of luck. Beginnings for their term.
Humble beginnings, but good for personal fitness.
I should point out the oil price is going to break through $50 a barrel today. It's down $3. There's some news.
Wow.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. So a solution to the debt crisis, get yourself a partner. Anthony Harrison writes on our website, for the last 8 years here in New York City, while my friends and colleagues have been driving Escalades and Range Rovers and living in overpriced apartments. My wife and I drove a Jeep Wrangler and lived in a little cheap apartment in the Bronx. We stayed on a strict budget and bought very little. We now have little to no debt. I love this woman. 877-8-MY-TAKE if you want to send a debt valentine to the show here at The Takeaway. MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Debtor Nation, our week-long series.
I think he's on to something there. We're going to move on and talk about President-elect Barack Obama and his appointments. From all sides, it looks like he's going to appoint former Senator Tom Daschle to serve as Secretary of Health and Human Services. In our latest installment of America's Briefing Book, we're asking, what does the president-elect need to know before his administration takes over that agency? We're joined by Dr. Helene Gayle. She is the president and CEO of CARE, the international organization. She's formerly the director of the Gates Foundation's HIV, TB, and Reproductive Health Program. She also served at the CDC for more than 20 years. Welcome, Dr. Gayle.
Hi. Good morning.
President-elect Obama has certainly set out an ambitious plan when it comes to health care. What kind of shape is the Health and Human Services Administration in to carry out any of it?
Well, I think, you know, HHS has a long history and a large workforce of very dedicated people, but I think there's a lot that will need to be done if the priority of making high-quality and affordable health care accessible to all is actually going to be met. So I think, there's a lot of re-energizing, reprioritizing of these issues that will need to take place. And I think a big job, we know that the health care reform efforts under the Clinton administration were not able to move forward in the way that had been hoped for. So there's a lot that needs to be done, and I think there's a lot of rebuilding across HHS, because I think it's important for people to remember that HHS is not only health care, it's also human services, and the overall mission really is the health, safety, and well-being for all Americans. And, you know, at a time with an economic downturn that we're currently facing, these programs are probably going to be more important than ever before, as we know that health and well-being are so impacted by the economic forecast.
Oh, certainly. And what do you think, given all of those things that you've just laid out, the appointment of Tom Daschle says about President-elect Obama's intentions?
Well, I think, first of all, it says that he is placing a high priority on this set of issues. Senator Daschle clearly has a very distinguished career. He recently put out a book about health care and these issues. He has a good relationship with Congress, and I think moving forward anything like health care reform is going to take really close ties and working together with Congress to make sure that we get the kind of health care reform that I think Americans are hoping for. So I think it really signals the importance and the priority that President-elect Obama places on this set of issues.
Health care is clearly a very complicated issue that affects tens of millions of Americans, particularly those that don't have any. How do you begin that conversation? And if you were to advise Senator Daschle, what would you say to him?
Well, I think, first of all, while I think, you know, clearly he has a real foundation and understanding of the issues, it's going to be important to reach out to people. I think it's going to be important to listen to people who have experience. I think, you know, I hope that he will call together a wide range of people who represent the spectrum of the issues that need to be addressed. I think reaching out to Congress early on to start thinking about how to work together on these issues is going to be important. And then I think very early on beginning to set very clear priorities around this so that there is a dialogue about this issue moving forward.
You mentioned Tom Daschle's book. It's called Critical, What Can We Do About Health, the Healthcare Crisis? And he's proposed in it a federal health board, something similar to the Federal Reserve System, that would essentially merge Medicaid and Medicare and expand health benefits to provide universal coverage. It sounds very ambitious.
Well, I think it's ambitious, but I think what we're talking about to really make high-quality and affordable health care accessible to all is ambitious. And so whether that idea is the one to that will ultimately be the one that will move forward or not, I think thinking big and bold and broad about this is important. And I think the idea of being more integrated in the way that we look at this is a key factor. So whether the health board itself is the idea or not, I think it is going to take innovation, thinking boldly, but also building on what we know. You know, there's a lot of information out. I think, you know, this is an issue that has been studied. The Institute of Medicine, for instance, has recently done a report looking at these issues. There's a body of information that can be built upon. So I think it's going to be the combination of new, innovative thinking along with building on the foundation of what we already know and setting clear priorities early on and having that open dialogue.
Very quickly, in terms of a timeline, what do you think it's reasonable for the American public to expect in the first year or two of this new administration?
Well, I think as it relates to HHS, you know, I think in the first 90 days or so, it will be important to look across the department and start setting priorities overall. You know, HHS, again, it's a wide-ranging department that goes from Medicaid and Medicare services to the Centers for Disease Control, the FDA, NIH, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services mm-hmm. Agency, Administration for Children and Families, et cetera, Administration on Aging. So this is a wide range of agencies that focus on health but also on safety and well-being of the population. And I think it is coming together and thinking about what are the highest priorities so that HHS can move together and move its very, very important mandate. And, you know, as I said, in these times, perhaps more important
right.
than ever.
Sounds like Senator Daschle certainly has his work cut out for him. Thank you, Dr. Gale. Dr. Helene Gale is the president and CEO of CARE International. And now we head to Mark Garrison, who's got a few headlines for us.
Thank you, Adora. Coming up on 20 minutes before the hour, Wall Street is open for business. The Dow is down around 1%. Generally gloomy day as far as the economy goes. Asian markets plunged almost 7%. Key European indices down as well. Also, last hour we learned jobless numbers are at a 16-year high, actually worse than economists expected. Some 542,000 applications for unemployment benefits came in. With consumers cutting back, it's been tough on Chinese exports. Chinese businesses are closing from a lack of orders and people are getting laid off. Today, China called the situation grim. The country's national police chief has warned that job losses could spark social unrest. And the FBI has boosted the reward for information about its group of suspected eco-terrorists known as the Family. It's now five times as much. That's $50,000. Investigators suspect them of causing tens of millions of dollars in damage.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Markets open. The Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 are tracking about 2% lower at this hour. But the big story is perhaps Citigroup. Citigroup's stock blasted through $10 a share this week and now is hovering around $6 a share. And one of the major investors in Citigroup, Sheikh Al-Waleed bin Talib, the Saudi sheikh, who had a stake of 4% in Citigroup, decided to raise his stake this morning after the stock fell to $6 a share. And Citigroup opened this morning, despite Al-Waleed's, the sheikh's purchases, has opened lower. It's now trading down more than 10%, $5.71 a share. Joining us now to talk about the Citigroup situation, is it a crisis of confidence? Is it a crisis of management? Is a fellow at the Cass Business School in London, Peter Hahn, who's also a former Managing Director at Citigroup. Peter Hahn, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning.
What do you make of the fact that, you know, Sheikh Al-Waleed's purchase this morning didn't even move the needle upward? I mean, it's a major purchase and a major sort of attempt to inject confidence into Citigroup, but it didn't do anything.
Well, he's got a lot at stake, and I'd have to say he rode the stock up from his early 90s investment and then rode it down. And he really didn't seem to have influenced a number of poor decisions that were made by Citi over time. So it's hard to see investors getting confidence by him buying more.
What is the pressure point for Citigroup management to begin to sell assets that have real value? I mean, stock is, you know, maybe going to cross under $5 a share today if things go south.
I think on Citi, there's been a hope that it could convince the market that its management was capable of keeping it running as the global organization that it's been. But I think the market's losing confidence in a number of banks and saying that maybe it's the time to break up a number of large institutions into smaller, more manageable ones.
The enabling mechanism for Citigroup to grow into this enormous financial conglomerate was the deregulated environment in banking and investment banking that has led up to this financial meltdown. Would you say that the fortunes of Citigroup are also the landmark that sort of spells the end of this deregulated environment?
I think it's hard to say that. Deregulation was really a long-term process. Many people, I think, forget. Glass-Steagall fell in 98 after the Citigroup merger, but it had been whittled away for almost 20 years before. Citicorp, one of the predecessor banks, had major securities operations outside the U.S. and significant presence in the U.S. already by that time. By the time Glass-Steagall was done, America's large corporate banks were already significantly in investment banking.
Well, let's talk about what's going to happen today. If Citigroup goes significantly farther down below $5 a share quickly, and we just have a few seconds, what does it mean for the rest of the financial sector in the United States?
It's a bellwether that confidence hasn't returned yet to the financial sector. It's probably an excess amount of pessimism, as we've had an excess amount of optimism in the last few years.
And I suspect you're pretty comfortable over there at the Cass Business School, having been a former managing director at Citigroup, eh, Professor?
Well, I think our banks here have a similar challenge,
right.
And we think it's getting stable.
Classroom activities certainly at Cass Business School. Peter Hahn is a former managing director at Citigroup, now a fellow at the Cass Business School, talking about Citigroup from London. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 20th, and here's a question for you. Give us the best way to get out of debt.
Hi, Anne from Shrewsbury. The motto should be, do what you can with what you've got, what you know you've got. I think the last couple generations have never learned how to cook. For the price of a Big Mac, you could put together a meal for four people with rice, beans, and basic things that are really good for you and would probably combat obesity.
We want to hear all suggestions for combating debt. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now we turn to Mark Garrison because we also want to know what the headlines are this morning.
Thank you. Coming up on 11 minutes before the hour, the Dow is down around 2% at the moment. Global markets are all seeing sell-offs. Japan's Nikkei plunged almost 7%, and European indices so far are down 2-3%. The experts didn't think the news would be this bad this morning as far as jobless claims. Those went up to a 16-year high. The government says new applications for benefits rose to 542,000. Senate Republicans announced key leadership positions yesterday. John Boehner of Ohio stays on as minority leader. Eric Cantor of Virginia replaces Roy Blunt of Missouri in the number two spot of Minority Whip. And a bellwether state finally rang, but the tone was off. Missouri actually missed the mark on picking the president. John McCain won Missouri. Results came in yesterday. McCain won by a tight margin, less than 4,000 votes. Now, when we say bellwether, we mean that prior to this election, Missouri voted for the winning candidate in every election this century except for one. The actual, if you're curious, the one where they got it wrong was 1956, and Adlai Stevenson won Missouri over Eisenhower by about the same amount of votes that McCain just got, about 3,900 votes. So maybe the theory was maybe it was the same people that that put him over the edge.
Interesting. The crisis in Missouri. Thank you, Mark.
Now they know.
So if you've been to a museum and you love to look at the art and think about the story of how the art came to be, think about another story, how the art came to be in the museum that you're in. The story of how art treasures got into Western museums around the world is a sometimes lurid story, and it's the basis for the book Loot, The Battle of Stolen Art Treasures of the Ancient World. It is written by former New York Times reporter Sharon Waxman, the author of the Waxword blog, and a reporter who I've known for a long time. We met for the first time back in the Middle East eons ago. Sharon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, this is a great story of three things. It seems to me it's a great story of the ancient world attempting to, like countries like Egypt, attempting to take control over treasures that they have really lost control over the last 300-400 years. It's also an amazing story of the personality and characters behind some of the greatest museums in the world. Let's begin with Egypt. What is Egypt trying to do to preserve its treasures and take back stuff that was looted from it over hundreds of years?
Those are two different questions, because what they're doing to preserve things and what they're doing to get back are two different paths. They are trying to build new museums and improve a pretty horrible record, actually, of preservation. I wouldn't say it's so much a horrible record as it's an overwhelming task, because Egypt has so very much to care for, and it has issues like pollution and issues like lack of resources, because it's a poor country. But on the other track, there is a campaign by the chief archaeologist of Egypt, a very charismatic and unshy man called Zahi Hawass, to bring back five pieces from the five major Western museums, including the Rosetta Stone and the bust of Nefertiti, which are two of the most recognizable Egyptian artifacts out there in the world. And he says these pieces are too important to the Egyptian cultural identity to be outside the country, no matter how they left. And most of the pieces, and by the way, I should say, Egypt is a story of really plunder and loot, like the title of the book suggests. In the 19th century, it was just absolutely a playground for Europeans who just came in and kind of denuded the country.
So let's talk about some of the institutions where that treasure ended up. We've got the Metropolitan Museum in New York, which you devote an entire chapter to. Its history begins in a rather...
with plunder, like most of the great museums, yes, not of Egypt. The Egyptian artifacts, I should specify, are not a question of plunder at the Met, but certainly the core of the Met came from, for example, Cyprus, where the man who became the first director of the Met, Emanuele Cesnola, had a couple of hundred workers digging for him on Cyprus, where he was the consul general.
How did he get it into the States?
Oh, it wasn't an issue of there were no export bans, or there was no controls at that time. So it wasn't there are export bans now, but in those days, you just kind of took it in a lot of cases.
But there's a great story that it was actually wrong of the American consul to So tell that story.
Oh, that story is a good one. Yeah. Okay. So a lot of the ancient world at that time was under the Ottoman Empire, and when the Ottoman Empire got wind of the fact that Cesnola had all of this stuff that he was going to send back under diplomatic cover, they sent a warship to stop the boat from leaving. And in a brilliant Byzantine bit of, I don't know, not trickery. The edict did not, it just so happened that Cesnola was also the acting Russian consul for various reasons of alliances at that time. And there was no edict against the Russians for taking out antiquities. So they took it out under a Russian flag.
So he magically transformed himself into a Russian.
Yeah.
How has the Met improved its reputation over time?
Well, let's just say this is not... The issues are not about the Met's reputation in terms of its origins. The origins of most of the great museums, as I say, and as we discussed at a panel at NYU last night with some people who are far more scholarly than I, they're embarrassing. You know, they're frankly embarrassing, and they're lost in the mists of time for good reason, although I think that they should be discussed today because they have given rise to these restitution battles. But the problem is that in more recent times, when there are some more recently smuggled things that have been bought by the Metropolitan, Neapolitan, whether it was the Euphronius crater that went back in January, or whether it's the story of this Lydian hoard, these beautiful objects, 350 gold and silver objects that Turkey sued over in the 1980s. The Met, like most institutions, did not respond with transparency and forthcomingness. They just kind of battened down the hatches till they had to give it back.
It just sounds like a free-for-all on every level and on every continent.
It was in the 19th century. There are rules today, and there are guidelines.
And not following those guidelines led to an amazing story at the Getty Museum in your neck of the woods out in Los Angeles. So we can't go without talking about the story of the Getty.
Well, the story of the Getty is particularly interesting because it's one of the only cases we have of trying to put together an antiquities collection in modern times. I mean, how do you do that? So much stuff is already in museums or in private collections. So the Getty, you know, had to spend an awful lot of money to buy things, and it turns out that they were buying things that were being dug up, and it was kind of feeding the looting market, these smuggling groups, particularly in Italy and Greece and places like that. But it was at a time, let's say the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, it was really don't ask, don't tell. Everybody would kind of turn a blind eye. But then suddenly Italy woke up to this idea that they needed to go back and reclaim things or try to shut down this smuggling that was going on. And so they decided to sue the curator of the Getty, who had been, so she is still under criminal charges in Italy, Marion True, for having essentially done her job by following the norms of that time, but that are we're talking 20 years ago, that are no longer acceptable. So she's being sued under Italian law, and she was being sued so that to put pressure on the Getty to give back what Italy was claiming. And in the end, a year ago, the Getty caved and gave it back. But of course, Marion True's reputation is destroyed, and her career is over, and she remains on trial.
Indeed, the Getty's reputation is immeasurably degraded as a result of that. Sharon Waxman, author of the book Loot, The Battle of the Stolen Treasures of the Ancient World, joined us in the studio. Thanks.
So interesting. With rumors that Senator Hillary Clinton might be Barack Obama's Secretary of State, here's a thought on a takeaway.
When you invite the Clintons in to your tent, you accept a certain amount of drama and controversy that comes with that.
That's Peter Baker from our partner, the New York Times. And, of course, we've been following the debate over the bailout of the auto industry.
My name is Lloyd Jacobson from Brewster, and I don't think the government should bail out the big three. They've taken a long time coming around to try to create fuel-efficient cars. They've left themselves hanging. I really think that the oil companies should bail out the big three because they've been in bed together for so many years. They should start scratching each other's back a little bit more.
There's a thought, and we're asking for more of your advice.
Beth Logan from Massachusetts. I was calling about debt. There's three things that we do. The first one is we do budget. The second one is, despite the fact that we have two incomes, we have bought a house based on one income, which pays off since we've both been laid off since we've been married. And the third one is we use credit unions instead of banks.
Three strategies from our listener, Beth. That's advice for our series, Debtor Nation. We want your tips and tricks, how to get out of debt, how to stay out of debt. 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org.
We've got something special on our website. Alvin Hall, financial consultant, is going to be taking your questions. He's actually taking them right now about getting out of debt. Send your questions now. Return to the website at thetakeaway.org for a live Q&A that's going to be on Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern. And if you missed anything, you know where we are on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.